Today, we're all going to learn a new term. It's only two words. Now listen closely. Can all of you say constructive fraud?
Constructive fraud!
Did you ever get the feeling as you're staring at the ceiling that this game of life we play ain't fair? Seems as fast as we can make it, there's a hand that grabs and takes it till they find us in a grave somewhere. Like a rodent on a treadmill, we keep pushing for it uphill, but we never seem to get too far. Well, if you think you're being taken, then you're ready to awaken to the truth of what we really are. We're all indentured servitudal slaves, overburdened and bewildered feudal knaves, who have lost our soul posterity through ignorance and apathy, and now we're being taxed out of our graves. And as long as we stay passive, we'll succumb, contented with some socialistic crumb. Well, the naked truth and fact is we're all saps who pay our taxes, and that is why the banksters keep us dumb. Could the state of our condition be the product of omission, what we didn't learn in public schools? And did our fathers all through history all fight and die for liberty so we could play the tyrant's fools? And can you call it education when it's all indoctrination to obey the hidden powers that be? Did we fight the revolution? Did we win the world wars just to slumber into slavery? We're all indentured servitudal slaves, overburdened and bewildered feudal knaves, who have lost our soul posterity through ignorance and apathy, and now we're being taxed out of our graves. And as long as we stay passive, we'll succumb, contented with some humanistic crumb. Well, the naked truth and fact is we're all saps who pay those taxes, and that is why the banksters keep us dumb. While Franklin and Eleanor were telling us they hated war, they made a deal behind our back. They said the bankers could enslave us for a portion of our wages, and today we call it income tax. But what they failed then to tell us was the way they planned to sell us into statutory slavery. Now it's called constructive fraud. Some even claim the wrath of God. I call it social insecurity. Let's stop being indentured servitudal slaves, overburdened and bewildered feudal knaves, and reclaim our lost posterity. Rise up and proclaim liberty. It's high time we rock the boat and make some waves. 'Cause as long as we stay passive, we'll succumb. They'll starve us on their communistic crumb. And the naked truth and fact is we don't have to pay those taxes. Yes, it's time we show those banksters, those international gangsters. So let's turn the tables and spoil all their fun.
That's all.
The real great adventures of me, Tom Terrific, with Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog.
Terrific! Terrific, greatest hero ever. Terrific is the name for me, 'cause I'm so clever. I can be what I wanna be, and if you'd like to see, follow, come follow me. If you see a plane on high, a diesel train go roaring by, a bumblebee or a tree, it's me! When there is trouble, I'm there on the double, from Atlantic to Pacific. They know I'm terrific.
I'm Mighty Manfred.
the Wonder Dawn, and Tom's ever faithful companion.
Well, that Wonder Dog is not too wonderful anymore. He's a little hard to get up out of the bed. He wants to sleep all day behind the stove. Yeah. Hey, I'm in the bunker again this morning. Yeah, hard to believe, but I'm here on duty. Yes, sir. No, sir. Yeah. It is, December the 30th, 2015. This is it. Tonight's the night. Wow. Okay. Anyhow, it's not too cold out. It's in the high 40s. And it's overcast, though. We've had a lot of overcast. It's cool, but not too bad. At least we're not getting those tornadoes. I noticed in the local fish wrap, they said they're going to set up some tornado warning sirens. Now, what they used to do was when there was any possibility, you saw a tornado coming, they'd set off a few sticks of dynamite outside of town. But they don't do it anymore. They're doing this modern stuff now with the sirens going. They said, watch out, we're going to try those damn things out pretty quick. So don't run for the hills, man. You know what I can't understand is how come these people live in areas where there's tornadoes quite a bit? Why don't they have either basements or underground hideaways, bomb shelters or something? If you had a mobile home, you'd be crazy not to have something underground. It's not that hard to build a little dugout. I can't understand it. People dying, you know. He was talking about this black guy who was sitting in a wheelchair in the middle of his living room in his house, and all the stone walls or cement block walls fell down around him. Didn't hurt him. He had a minor cut, but he could have been squashed. And, you know, I don't know what to do. It's hard for me to have a lot of sympathy for people who won't take minimum precautions if a tornado is coming. Well, we're still over at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And that's where you get your January donations in for the show. And several of you already have done that. So that's good. Thank you very much. And let's see here. And then we go up to resist.com. I haven't checked on the numbers of people who are checking into that website lately. I should do that and see if anybody's even knocking on the door. Well, we started a big project yesterday, my friends did, and the webmaster. We're going to put all those old television shows and Race and Reason shows up on the YouTube. So they'll be there for posterity, hopefully. But we put up the first one yesterday. It was Wyatt Kaldenberg and I talking about things. He was a democratic socialist. He was a Trotskyite when he was 14 years old. How about that? Okay, what the hell are we going to do today, boys and girls? Let's get back into our pessimist guide to history. How about that? 1755, a severe earthquake rocks Boston. The worst earthquake ever experienced in the history of Boston, Massachusetts, occurred in the early morning on November the 18th. The ground heaved with a long, wave-like motion. Fissures opened and walls and chimneys collapsed, but no one was killed. And you thought earthquakes in America only hit California. 1756, Black Hole of Calcutta. This little incident struck back at the forces of imperialism following the capture of the Turkish-held Calcutta by native rebels on June the 20th. Some 64 British prisoners were locked up for the night in a small prison cell measuring just 18 feet by 15 feet with only two small windows for air. The crowding and oppressive heat proved more than the men could stand, so they soon began to suffer from lack of air as well as dehydration. One by one, they began to drop, and by morning, all but 21 had suffocated to death in the cramped prison cell. The incident gained widespread attention, at a time when British colonial rule was expanding in India. Originally, the number of men crowded into the cell had been put at 146, but that figure was later found to be exaggerated. 1769 to 1770, Indian famine kills millions. An 18-month drought in the Hindustan of India created a terrible famine in the province. Millions of people starved to death. 1760, and that's millions now, not thousands. 1769, lightning ignites a powder magazine. Huge quantities of gunpowder were being stored at the Church of the Saint-Nazaire in the northern Italian city of Brescia, when on August the 18th, a bolt of lightning set fire to the church. Soon after, the powder magazine exploded, killing 3,000 people and demolishing all the buildings in the surrounding area. Well, that's the old God up there spreading his love around. Yeah. Who's the idiot that wants to store the gunpowder in the church? 1770, French ship sinks, killing 700. The Elorama, a French merchant ship carrying over 700 passengers and crew, sank during a storm off Valparaiso in modern Chile. Only a handful survived. I wonder which hand. 1772, Java volcano blows its top. Papandayan in 1870-foot volcano in Java erupted with a great explosion on August 11th and 12th, blowing away about 4,000 feet of the top of the volcano cone. Over 40 villages and towns were destroyed, and some 3,000 people were killed. 1776, that's an interesting number. Caribbean hurricane ravages shipping trade. Some 6,000 people aboard the convoy of French and Dutch merchant ships were drowned on September 6th when a deadly hurricane sank 100 of the ships of the Point Bay Monique. Now the French and Dutch are joining the Spanish. Well, it's interesting that the weather did a revolution at the same time we had a revolution here. How about that? Well, we got a preacher here that's just all upset with the racism and people like you and me, Reverend Graylin Hagler and Dan Joseph, debate racism. Let's listen in and see what they're talking about.
On all this, what's your reaction to the apparent role that the PC backlash is playing in our politics at a crucial time as the parties winnow their fields from right. 4 and 8 and 10 down to 1, and eventually, of course, we'll have a head-to-head battle between the top Democrat, top Republican.
But let's understand what we're talking about. When we're talking about political correctness, right, you're talking about respecting other people. You're talking about being respectful of other people, allowing people to have their own dignity. And political incorrectness is racist, it's xenophobic, because it really, in a sense, diminishes people's humanity. It is the most negative things that anybody can say about somebody else. So it characterizes people in negative ways. It stereotypes people in ways that are ultimately destructive. When we look at the Donald Trump phenomenon, we need to look also at the history of this country. One, the history of this country is racist in its character. There are some challenges that white America has had to face and in the last 6 years or so, which has been the election of a black president. And there has been a clear response to that president to try to do everything in order to block him, diminish the dignity of the office because he's in there, and we've seen that type of reaction in Reconstruction after the Civil War. Again, people tried to basically restore the Confederacy back to office and did so after the compromise, right? And so we're really facing this kind of white supremacist paradigm all over again.
Dan, can you help, for people who don't quite get the feelings that are out there. Can you help us?
Sure, sure. No.
Wrap our brain around. Put a little more meat on the bone.
We always hear from civil rights leaders, from activists, from many on the liberal side, that we need to have a conversation about race in this country. Unfortunately, that conversation has been made much harder because many white Americans are afraid to say what they believe because they know that if they do say what they believe, that they will be accused of being, as the Reverend said, racist, bigots. These are words that have been thrown around so much that to many Americans, they've almost lost all meaning. While at the same time, we know very, very well that if you say the wrong thing in this country, if you appear racially insensitive, you can even lose your job. It can hurt your career. It can do a lot of damage to you. And I think people...
No, but you're failing to admit that there is a paradigm in this country, a historical paradigm that is built upon white supremacy, that basically characterizes and uses people of color as tools to be exploited. Even the announcement of Donald Trump, for example, was a code word of race when he talked about Mexicans being rapists and murderers, right? Not robbers and murderers, not extortionists and murderers, but rapists. That's the old type of code language telegraphed to the white community that you need to be careful with your women because there's the big brown boogeyman that's lurching in the dark. It's the same kind of scenario that folks talked about in terms of black.
I'm not sure if Donald Trump is deep enough to know that. But let me put it this way.
But even the other day when he talked about Hillary Clinton being, and used that Yiddish word, again.
Please don't say it.
Right, I'm not going to say that word. Right.
But I want to say
here's the truth about what we see going on in this country right now. When real, actual racism rears its head, when it reared its head in Charleston, South Carolina, when it reared its head with Donald Sterling, you saw the entire country come together, unite, and condemn it. Now, there are other situations, like the situation with Michael Brown, where the facts weren't known, and that's where the Black Lives Matter movement got its impetus. They came out, they rioted, they started...
Don't even talk about that they operated on a wrong premise.
When
we
We can't hear both at one time.
When you say...
And you need to wise up and open up your eyes and see that there has been a historical pattern in this country of white supremacist violence against black people.
When you say the facts weren't known in Ferguson, you think there's some ambiguity about what happened?
Well, there's no ambiguity about it. Michael Brown didn't have his hands up when he was shot. Now, the Black Lives Matter movement, even after all the facts were released, still went on with this lie. They still based their entire movement on this one event, and any other movement would have lost all credibility at this point because of that.
You historically mischaracterized it. It has nothing to do with a point in history. It's a historical pattern. It was just that there was a spark that brought people together. There was an original...
I love to get in the ring with these kind of blacks, shove it down their throat. Hell, I'll agree with him. Of course we're racist. We've always been racist. Of course we were founded on racism. And we're going to be very racist for a long time, and probably forever. So I love to climb down the throats of these loudmouth blacks. But I don't get on there much to do it anymore. But anyhow, that's the conservative right-wing so-called racists are limp-wristed. They're always backing down. Well, we're not like those racists. Yeah, we're not really racist. They're a bunch of lying hypocrites. I hate them. Boy, we got some fine niggers down there in Texas. A Texas mom and boyfriend are charged in the death of a 19-month-old found in the oven. Raquel Thompson, 25, reportedly left her four children home alone for about 2 hours to go out for pizza with her boyfriend, Cornell Malone, and returned to find her youngest Yazira Thompson child burning in the oven. Well, I guess they didn't want to wait for the pizza. I mean, this shows you how depraved these people can be. But don't you dare call them niggers. Don't you dare. Well, I see another Negro, Nicky Manja's brother, arrested and charged with the raping of a 12-year-old girl. That's more the style of the Mexicans. See here, another nigger in California was arrested for burning his girlfriend alive on Christmas Day. 51-year-old Clarence Deer, D-E-A-R, is being held on $1 million bail after being accused of dousing a woman with gasoline and burning her to death. This goes on every day, different places around the country. Every day, day in and day out. Well, here's a little bit that you may not have picked up. I went up to YouTube last night a little bit, and there was an old Donald Trump clip of him in his fight with that stupid comedian. I forgot his name now, but anyhow, he challenged Donald Trump to sue him. Donald Trump sued him for $5 million. Well, the first thing out of his mouth said he's going to take the $5 million and give it to this Jewish outfit, which may give you a little clue about what's going on there. I wonder if his father was Jewish or his mother was Jewish or what. I think we need to research that a little bit, because he is surrounded by Jews in his business, and in New York they're all over him, so... Don't trust that boy any more than they do any of the others. Well, looks like Obama's buddy, old Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, is starting to feel the heat. Yeah, starting to feel the bite of the political machine he spent decades protecting as more calls come from his resignation. When the poverty pimp Al Sharpton calls for you to resign, you know it's time to leave your vacation in Cuba and handle the powder keg set to explode in your city. Maybe Emmanuel could pick up a few pointers from Fidel Castro on how to handle the protesters before returning to the Windy City. Honestly, I believe we are more worried about the conditions in Chicago than Rahm Emanuel. Emanuel was brought up in the political machine. He was raised in it. He is Barack Obama with an actual spine. He knows and understands the hierarchy of patronage. He helped build the modern structure of Chicago political machine, and he knows how to destroy it just as easy. Well, in his book, Sapphire's Political Dictionary, the late William Sapphire, syndicated writer for the New York Times, defines political machine as the election of officials and the passage of legislation through the power of an organization created for political action. A political machine is created through community organizing that results in rules, regulations, and laws to push a political purpose. Those of us that don't spend our lives dreaming of ways to control a population for political power will say corruption is simple. So it looks like old Rahm Emanuel, he's going to be out of there pretty soon. You had a real white supremacist mayor up there in Chicago, things would run pretty smooth, I can guarantee you. Well, I see Brother Bill Cosby will face an aggravated indecent assault charge, his first criminal charge for his alleged conduct against white women, prosecutors announced on Wednesday. Pennsylvania prosecutors issued an arrest warrant for the alleged sexual assault that happened more than a decade ago. Montgomery County First Assistant to District Attorney Kevin Steele said that the first-degree felony charge stemmed from a sexual assault that took place in early 2004 in Cosby's home. Steele said the victim came to consider Mr. Cosby her mentor and her friend after the two met through their work at Temple University. Steele said the victim was penetrated without her consent while she was impaired. I wonder, did he shoot her with an arrow or something? Penetrated? There is not a question in terms of pills being provided to her. There is not a question as to what went on of the digital penetration, Steele said. Well, my position is very simple. He should be charged, but the women, white women, who would lay with this non-nincompoop should be charged too. I think they should be charged maybe even more than him. That's my position. Any white woman who would lay down with Bill Cosby, she asked for it and she got it. I would be very shocked if Bill Cosby goes to jail for this. I think he's going to get maybe 10 years probation or something like that. But I'll bet you anything he doesn't do jail time, unless I'm very sadly mistaken, white boy. Well, I see by the Guardian newspaper that U.S. police killed 1,126 people so far this year. That's interesting. I wonder, of course, probably two-thirds of them were legitimate. Maybe not, but I assume so. But probably nearly 100% of them were overreacting cops. Well, whoopee, a top official at the pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson dismissed questions on a recent earnings call about the drug price reform debate in Washington, saying that the company is responsible in its pricing. As part of the question, the answer period, during the company's third quarter earnings call in October, one questioner asked Johnson & Johnson Chief Financial Officer Dominic Caruso where he sees the drug pricing reform debate in Washington going and if the company was planning a pledge similar to the one made by many firms in 1990 to not raise drug prices beyond cost inflation here in this country because they dropped the bottom out of the prices in the foreign countries. In Black Africa, these drugs are only charged a small percentage. Yeah. Despite significant media attention on drug pricing, there really isn't a consensus on policy solutions that would lower prices without negatively lowering innovation, he said, unquote. After recalling the industry's collaboration on the Affordable Care Act, Caruso then told the questioner that the real answer to this dilemma is to monitor and provide outcome-based metrics and not simply focus on price. Unquote. Finally, Caruso, in response to a question about the industry voluntarily restraining the prices of its own drugs, explained that he would rather focus on justifying the current prices of drugs. Quote, I think we're very responsible in our drug pricing, and we tend to support the price of our drugs with strong economic data, he said. So rather than pledge to a particular number, I think it's important that we continue to develop robust data that provides a solid foundation for the value of our products provide the health care system. Oh, boy. What a bunch of gobbledygook that was. Quote, Johnson & Johnson's justification for their prescription drug prices are outrageous, a health care advocate at the Public Citizen told The Intercept in response to Caruso's comments to investors. Sick patients and taxpayers are held hostage in order for drug makers to extract extreme profits. Das pointed to the investor documents. Johnson & Johnson uploaded that show that the company spent 12.6% of its total sales in research and development, compared to 26.6% it spent on selling, marketing, and administrative expenses. This means the company was spending twice as much on marketing and sales as on actual developing of new drugs. Johnson & Johnson has gained notoriety for the high cost of its drugs. For example, it produces and markets a cancer drug, Imbruvica, which retails at around $9,550 for one bottle of 90 capsules. Dosage is 4 capsules a day, meaning one bottle will be a 22.5-day supply, costing over $9,000. at this average price, a full year's supply would cost $154,922. Take that, you peasants. Another drug it produces is Alicio. It's used to treat hepatitis C. This drug retails for at around $22,000 on the low end for around a month's supply. Altogether, that equals $264,000 for an annual supply. Quote, hepatitis treatment, C treatment, costs are forcing state governments to consider rationing care for their Medicaid and prison rolls, said Doss. Instead of simply charging less, this industry is outdoing itself every year, extracting huge profits at the expense of our poor and the sick. Well, I think it's about time to nationalize the drug industry myself. If I was in control or in power, that's what I'd do immediately. Nationalize the goddamn thing. When they charge people that much, what they're saying is, we don't really give a fuck if you die. Well, happy days. Microsoft, if you bought one of their newer computers, devices, is that disk encryption is built in and turned on by default, protecting your data in case your device is lost or stolen. But what is less well known is that if you are like most users and log into Windows 10 using your Microsoft account, your computer automatically uploaded a copy of your recovery key, which can be used to unlock your encrypted disk to Microsoft servers, probably without your knowledge and without an option to opt out. There you go. Aren't they nice? During the crypto wars of the 1990s, the National Security Agency developed an encryption backdoor technology, endorsed and promoted by the Clinton administration, Billy Boy, called the Clipper Chip, which is hoped telecom companies would use to sell backdoor crypto phones. Essentially, every phone with a Clipper chip would come with an encryption key, but the government would also get a copy of that key. This is known as the key escrow, with the promise to only use it in response to a valid warrant. Yeah, right. But due to a public outcry and the availability of encryption tools like PGP, which the government didn't control, the Clipper chip program ceased to be relevant in 1996. Today, most phone calls still aren't encrypted. You can use the free open source backdoorless Signal app to make encrypted calls. You know, I think it was last week I commented on Dr. Morell, Hitler's doctor, and the crap he was shooting up Hitler with. I just happened to run across a couple of pages here I thought I'd read to you. Whatever belonged to Hitler's privacy came out of the Hoffman stable of the Augean One. This metaphor refers to Eva Braun and Dr. Morell. All three were of Jewish origin, so the people closest to Hitler were abhorred by Morell's characteristic way of running business and his oriental physiognomy. As it was said by Christa Schroeder, a secretary to Hitler, when traveling, Hitler's assistants allowed this man, who often was coming late, to ride in their luggage car until the Führer harshly put an end to this practice. Before that, Mr. Morell was a ship physician for 1 year. During the First World War, he practiced in Deutzenbach in Hessen. In 1919, he became famous as the doctor for sexually transmitted diseases at a fashionable health resort, Kurfürstendamm, in Berlin, where with all kinds of magical remedies, he tried to cure aristocrats and ladies of low esteem. Once Morell drove to Hoffman, the private photographer of Hitler, in Berchtesgaden, who had gonorrhea. Morell injected him with something, and thankful, Hoffman recommended this venereal disease doctor to his friend Hitler, who suspected to have the same kind of illness. This was the way the fate had started. These two sly businessmen, Hoffman and Morell, came to terms immediately. Morell's occasional violations of abortion restrictions impinged on his reputation. He belonged to the so-called March Martyrs, who in January 33, after Hitler seized power, joined the NSDAP. Until 1936, Hitler was praised by everyone, especially by Churchill. But this, however, changed first slowly and then faster after the nomination of Dr. Morell as Hitler's private physician. After the application of boycotting measures, which should have resulted in the chasing Jews back to the desert, came pogroms and manslaughters. Thus, the German Reich became an enemy of God and of the world. Upon taking his post as a physician, Dr. Morell did two things at once. First, he tried poisoning Hitler slowly with strychnine injections, and then made Hitler dependent on him by application of a drug, pervitin. Pictures which were taken of Hitler after Morell's 8 years of care speak for themselves. While doing his job, he snatched up a few million marks and should be honored as Germany's war profiteer or swindler number one. On letters with the letterhead the Führer and the Reichschancellor, he issued orders. He took part in the Jewish pharmaceutical enterprise of Katz and Company in Budapest. He produced tons of multivitamin candies and sold them to the chief of the German Workers' Front, Dr. Ley, who looked like Morell, the same Ley whose great-grandfather, on his father's side, removed the letter V from his name. Professor Schenck, an executive officer with the chief of the Department of Public Health within the Reich's Ministry for Nutrition and Agriculture, estimated Morell's income from his factory alone at about 20 million marks. Every doctor who knew Morell called him a quack and a charlatan, and the English historian Trevor Roper, after being acquainted with him a little closer during an internment, called him a plump and old man with creepy manners, speaking chaotically, and with the hygiene habit of a pig. When Hitler's personal servant Krauss had a cold and was advised to go to Morell for a shot, Krauss answered, "I wouldn't allow Dr. Morell to give me a shot, for then I would have to go to him forever," unquote. Hitler's advice turned into the order, but Krauss disobeyed. Pretty soon, this soldier of the Navy was replaced by an SS man by the name of Linge. When the Prince von Schomburg-Lippe advised the Reich's propaganda minister, Dr. Goebbels, to get treated by Morell, irritated Goebbels replied, quote, "This criminal will not enter my house." Sometime Dr. Morell treated local or foreign guests of the Führer. In March 39, while talking with Göring and Ribbentrop, Czechoslovakian President Hacha became ill, so the Wunderbar miracles Morell gave him a shot in a hurry. Strengthened by this, the President Hacha entered Hitler's office and wrote down that, quote, from now, the destiny of Czechoslovakian nation lies in the Führer's hands, unquote. Sounds like he was taking some of those meth pills. In the middle of the war, chief of the SS Heinrich Himmler had noticed that Hitler's health worsened constantly, and that his personality changed due to this drug abuse. He cautiously tried to explain to the Führer the bad effects of the addiction, but Hitler flared up, and the chief gave up. Hitler wants to be a drug addict so he can scream victory in a war which he knew was already lost. Professor Schenck reported about this to his boss, SS Group Chief Leader Pohl. Quote, "The Führer is being doped by Morell to a high degree," unquote. And later, reported the same to Himmler. In effect, after a few days, Professor Schenck received an order to keep silent about this matter. Also, Professor Dr. Brandt, who said courageously to his Führer, quote, "With these injections, you are being slowly but progressively poisoned," was forced out of Hitler's elite and became unpopular. It is needless to say that a few months later, Dr. Brandt was under threat of execution. However, judges of the war court were unwilling to indict him, so Dr. Brandt survived as Hitler's private prisoner until the end of the war. In an extremely informative book written by the administrative function physician Dr. Roers, the author proved that Morell's drugs had poisonous effects bordering on destruction of human personality. Altogether, Morell's administered thousands of injections with which he handicapped freedom of action of his protege Hitler. An Israeli newspaper trivially asked, quote, "After the myth of stabbing the Germany with a dagger in her back, came another myth of miraculous medicine." And so on, no one living in these partitions of the great Germany paid any attention to Dr. Roers. Morell was promoted to a professor, and with his merit of war, a medal, left Berlin in April 21, 1945, after Hitler realized the drugs cannot help me anymore. Morell surrendered to Americans, and during the war criminals trial, he introduced himself as a hero of the resistance against the Nazis. But the historian Trevor Roper allowed the cat to get out of the sack a little bit in this way, quote, "With all the Hitler's doctors removed, Morell could look forward comfortably to the last and the most spectacular of his medical monopolies." One of those former physicians, Dr. Geising, in Stern magazine, praised himself because he once experimented on how to poison Hitler, but at the moment his personal servant, Lin, stepped into the bunker. After the investigation by an appropriate public prosecutor in Krefeld, it became obvious that Giesing's testimony was a hoax. Dr. Porschen of the Northern Rhine Physicians Association said that it's hard to imagine that such a break of the Hippocratic Oath could be treated seriously. Americans decided that Morell could not be held accountable, and so they let him keep his wealth in millions, which he hoarded during the war. They set him free, but hung the vigilant Dr. Brandt, for he started talking about Morell's medical practices inefficient in application of necessary care. Years after the war, Americans returned the Morell files, but because they were about Hitler's illnesses and treatments, the files disappeared. But the papers did not disappear from the collection which contained the information about Morell's lice powder branded Russia, which he was selling to the soldiers fighting in the East, who were laughing at it, for it was useless. Physician Morell, who pumped into Hitler and thus poisoned him throughout the war years with strychnine, Pervitin, and other drugs, after the war, before the Americans, he presented himself for this reason as a resistance fighter. His fortune of millions, which he piled up with the help of Dr. Ley, stayed untouched. So there you go. Goes out to the people who have asked me some questions about that. That's just a small amount of the information I have in my library. And I'm almost positive he had connections with Dr. Jacobson, Dr. Feelgood, with his meth concoction, too, until the SS ran him out of Germany. Then he came to Brooklyn, New York, and started pumping that shit into U.S. politicians and movie stars. Recently, I heard of a plan over in Finland that they're talking about installing, and maybe they have already, of supplying every citizen of Finland $500 every month to cut out all the whole so much bureaucracy in their social programs. This is interesting. Now, if you can keep your population under control, that would be fine. But if you can't, I don't think that would work. Anyhow, that reminds me of Dr. Townsend back in the 20s. He came up with a theory to get us out of the Depression. And he was promoting it really big until the Democrats, Roosevelt, absorbed a lot of his ideas into their program, even though it wasn't near as good. I got his book here, A Gripping Narrative of the Life of a Man Whose Economic Theories Have Profoundly Affected Contemporary America, and whose following among American voters is numbered in the millions, or was at that time. He used to fly all over California, I know, and he gave speeches to thousands of people. New Horizons is the autobiography of Dr. Francis E. Townsend. Carries the reader along with this 76-year-old prophet of plenty through the hard times after the Civil War on the Illinois prairies farms, through the rough and tumble politics of the Dakota frontier at the turn of the century, through two of California's golden booms and the depressions which followed. Dr. Townsend came to national prominence in the fall of 1933, when, with the Great Depression still fresh in people's minds, he advocated a generous system of federal annuities, payments to all past 60 who would retire from gainful employment and spend their pensions within 30 days. He recommended such payments as a means of stimulating a cash market for the goods and services of industry and agriculture to assure a return of a national prosperity. Well, what his plan was they called it $10 every Friday, to where everybody, according to this, over 60, it would be like Social Security, and that's pretty much how Roosevelt stole the ideas, but not as good as what Townsend had. But $10 every Friday in 33 would have been, and in fact during a depression, would have been great. So if you like Social Security today, and I think most senior citizens do, you can thank Dr. Townsend, Francis E. Townsend, for creating the idea and getting it going and getting enough pressure, because Roosevelt would have never adopted it if there hadn't been so much public pressure to adopt it. Townsend was giving Roosevelt a big run for his money at the time. Now, if you want to dig one of these books up, it may still be available out there someplace, called New Horizons, The Life Story of Townsend. Some of you might be interested in reading that. Just thought I'd give you a clue. Black Lives Matter now has teamed up with the Christ Insanity people. They just had a big powwow over in Illinois. Christ Insanity and Black Lives Matter. Boy, there's a combination. Well, Twitter's going to try to clamp down on everybody's free speech. Twitter Incorporated has clarified its definition of abusive behavior that will prompt it to delete accounts banning hateful conduct that promotes violence against specific groups. I wonder if they'll say that about white groups. The social media company disclosed the changes on Tuesday in a blog post. Following rising criticism, it was not doing enough to thwart Islamic State's use of the site for propaganda and recruitment. I think they're going to slip that in on everybody else, too. As always, we embrace and encourage diverse opinions and beliefs, but we will continue to take action on accounts that cross the line into abuse. Abuse is a very broad term. Megan Christini, director of Trust and Safety, said in the blog, "The new rules do not mention Islamic State or any other group by name." Interesting. quote, you may not promote violence against or directly attack or threaten other people on the basis of race, ethnicity, national origin, sexual orientation, gender, gender identity, religious affiliation, age, disability, or disease, according to the new rules. The company previously used a more generic warning that banned users from threatening or promoting violence against others. There you go, boys and girls. They're gradually closing the loop. Do you know what any criticism of non-whites by whites will be? Oh, that won't be allowed. Well, a lot of Jews have been moving out of France back over to Israel or over to Israel. Well, an Israeli organization with major funding from Christian donors brought 17 French Jews to Israel in what its founder said was an attempt to end the monopoly of the Jewish Agency for Israel. Jewish agency officials dismissed the move as smoke and mirrors by those crazy Christians designed to gain publicity. The French Jews brought to Israel by the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, or IFCJ, arrived Sunday. They constitute the first group whose aliyah, the Hebrew language term for Jewish immigration to Israel, was facilitated by the organization since it began working in France 6 months ago. IFCJ founder Rabbi Yanchiel Eckstein told JTA, well, you know, there's always a hook in the Christian stuff. The Jews are wise to the rise. Christians are always trying to put a hook in the deal to get Jews into Christianity, which I don't see why they try so hard. It's almost the same. It's funny as hell. They're always trying to bait the Jews into the Christian religion. And the Jews are there. You ain't pulling that shit on us. They even attacked Jews for Jesus. I remember in L.A. when Irv Rubin was chasing them all over town. And the Jewish Defense League was attacking Jews for Jesus. Well, this group, among nearly 7,900 Jews, a record number, who will have arrived this year from France, according to the Jewish agency's France dictated director, Daniel Beinheim. For a second straight year, France was Israel's largest providers of Jewish immigrants. Well, they're going to have to kick out some of those black Jews. They brought all those Somalian Jews and all those people in there. Well, you're going to have to make room for whiter Jews, European Jews now. The Jewish Agency is the only organization recognized by the Israeli government as a qualified and licensed to handle the immigration of Jews in France. That's interesting. Eckstein said the decision to start working in France followed his group's entry last year into the Ukraine as an aliyah facilitator. Oh, they're just gathering up Jews all over the place. Aren't these Christ insanity people something? French Jews came to us and asked us to do our aliyah program. He said, we believe we can help bring more French Jews in larger numbers by helping with their absorption. We'll find him a house. We'll find him a job. What? A Jewish agency spokesman called IFCJ's France operation smoke and mirrors for the media, just trying to steal our Jews for you Christians. IFCJ offers immigrants to Israel with a group 6 months rent. Hey, they give them 6 months rent or $1,000 one-time grant assistance. Not offered by the Jewish agency. Well, that's pretty interesting. I wonder if this Christian sect ever offers any Aryans 6 months rent, $1,000 cash. Yeah, there you go. They're even giving them some furniture. But Beinheim said the Olim coming with the IFCJ all registered with the Jewish agency, only to switch to the IFCJ flight because of its incentives. In other words, the Jews are jumping on this Christian bandwagon because they're going to get the $1,000 and get a place to live. And the Jewish agency is too cheap. Too cheap. There you go. There you go. That's Jaime. Pretty Christians taking that money out of the till of the church and giving it to the Jews. Isn't that wonderful? God. Here's an interesting one. If you're feeling lonely on this most Christian of days, just think of all that Jews and Christians have in common, namely infighting. In the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, located in Jerusalem's old city, I've been there, stands, or rather leans, a ladder. But this isn't any ladder. This is an immovable ladder. First mentioned in 1757, the immovable ladder isn't immovable because of Christian myth or miracle or magic. It's not a sword in the stone situation. This 250-year-old ladder is immovable because no changes can be made to the church without the consent of all six of the denominations that care for it. And as with our own sages, disagreements are common. Now, just the other day, I saw on the news they had a fist fight over there in that church. I walked around in that church, but you can only walk around there certain times. You see, the ladder is inconsequential. Who put it there? What minor repair it was used for? No one cares. What each of the sects do care about, however, is that no one does anything out of line. Case in point, in 2002, a Coptic monk moved his chair 20 centimeters out of the sun and consequently out of the Coptic-controlled part of the church. A fistfight broke out. People were hospitalized. Over the years, the immovable ladder has taken on a symbolic gravitas. In 1964, Pope Paul VI decreed that it would remain in place until a state of ecumenism was reached. In other words, all these religions come together, but we're not holding our breath, the guy that wrote this article. So there you go. If you go over to Israel, you know, I'm lucky I didn't move that damn ladder, try to get up on the roof or something. Those monks would have beat the hell out of me. What the hell is this one? Hunting Hitler on Noah's Ark. In 1992, the video game Wolfenstein 3D was released. I remember that. It was one of the first games where the TV screen showed the player's first-person point of view. When your character moves through the rooms, you actually did move through them. It was one of the major evolutions of video games. Oh, the game itself, it took place in the 40s. You assumed that the persona of a Polish spy, B.J. Blazkowicz, who may or may not be secretly Jewish, and your job was hunting Nazis. You held a gun visible in your fist in the corner of the screen. You'd shoot a Nazi, and tiny splats of red blood flew up, and it was supposed to be blood. Okay. But in 1992, the world of Super Nintendo wasn't ready for this realism. Wolfenstein was the only game ever to be banned for the system. So its makers sold the rights to an evangelical Christian company and redesigned Wolfenstein's Nazi chambers to be the floors of Noah's Ark. Instead of a machine gun, the player uses a slingshot to throw food laced with sleeping pills at angry animals. Called Super 3D Noah's Ark. The game wasn't a great commercial success, but was recently re-released for play on Macs and PCs. Curious? The whacked-out world of religion, man. Sure damn glad. I wish I'd have seen that ladder. I'd have moved it about a foot to the right, and it'd have been a riot. That would have been a riot in itself. My tour guide on the bus, everywhere we went, he said, "This is where we think a miracle happened." He never said one time, "This is where a miracle happened." It's just, we think this is where it happened. Well, the blacks are getting all excited about black lives are important. Black lives matter. Well, now they're starting it up in the Jewish community where you got a bunch of these black Jews running around. Jew Black Lives Matter too, man. Let's close out the show with a little theory, and who knows, false flag or not, it may be true about Lee Harvey Oswald.
As I read the war in volumes, I continued to find discrepancies again and again and again and again and again. I don't care whether it's Paul McBride saying he was with Oswald in 1958 in New Orleans when Oswald was in Japan in the military, whether it's Alan Feld, who said he was with Oswald in Memphis, Tennessee, when Oswald was supposed to be on a ship to Japan. You know, it goes on and on and on and on and on. The obvious things that are known, and I didn't spend much time at it, Oswald at a shooting range when Oswald's supposed to be with his wife in Irving, Texas, Oswald buying a car when he's supposed to be at another location. So this is preceding the assassination. Right. My point is that there are so many of these discrepancies that you become intrigued, and then your mind, at least my mind, turned to the point where I was looking for discrepancies. And there are lots of them. One thing leads to another. Oswald, to me, I don't speak Russian. I don't know anybody who does speak Russian. And Oswald's whole time in Russia is kind of, because of the language problem, is kind of a mystery, as it were. In the mid-1990s, I can't remember, I read an article that was translated from Spanish about a woman who lived in Argentina, Anita Zeiger. I recognized the name. Her father was Oswald's boss at the factory where he worked in Minsk. Talked to her on the phone through an interpreter, made arrangements to go out and see her. Didn't have any idea the questions to ask her or what I was looking for. It's just that I had an opportunity to meet someone who knew this man for a year and a half, or during the time he was in Russia. They took him to the train station when he left. I got on the plane with my friend interpreter, and we flew to Argentina. Anna was nice. She invited us to her house, gave us some little drinks called mate. She had some photographs which she showed us that she had taken in Russia of various people, Oswald included. Just basically talked about Oswald and Marina. And nothing was substantive. Nothing was revealing. Nothing was, oh my gosh. The second day, just as an off-the-cuff, offhanded remark, she was talking about her language abilities, and I said, well, how is Oswald Russian? And she turned to me, and with just the only word I can come up with is startled, a startled expression, she looked at me, kind of raised her eyebrows, and said, what? No, he didn't speak any Russian. And I was caught off guard, because in my mind, the only thing I'd ever heard year after year after year was the words of Marina. He spoke Russian with a Baltic accent. Perfect Russian. And, of course, Marina's remarks are substantiated by the people that they knew in Dallas in the white Russian community, one by one by one, in the Warren volumes, describing Oswald's ability to speak Russian as perfect. George de Morenshield said he preferred to reading classical Russian literature as opposed to reading English. You don't learn that by teaching yourself Russian at age 19 in the military. It just doesn't make any sense. So my point is, and I don't mean to take a long time or make this bigger than it is, but my point is, as the weeks and months go by, and as I read FBI reports or the Warren volumes or interview witnesses, one after another things just don't make sense. And there are very few situations that I investigated where it came to a dead end. Probably the dead end, if you will, was when I called John Pick in Lynn Haven, Florida, and I asked him about his remark to the Warren Commission about the fact that this photograph is not his brother. And as I've stated before, Pick said, I gave my testimony to the Warren Commission in 1964. I'll stand by that and have nothing further to say. So there's nothing I could do but say thank you and hang up the phone. In so many words, he confirmed that his testimony to the Warren Commission was accurate. He didn't say, John, that was not my brother. He simply said, I gave my testimony to the Warren Commission. I'll stand by that and have nothing further to say. You know, when you read things in the Warren volumes that don't make sense, then that's where I look and I try and find an answer. You wonder about these things. For example, Life magazine. You open Life magazine, there's Oswald. He does not look like the Oswald that was accused of shooting the president. Big husky kid in a classroom. Well, looks like he's got a missing tooth. Then I remember from reading the Warren volumes that Ed Vogel said he took the photograph. and he sold it to Life magazine for $75. And he said he thought he helped patch Lee up after a fight, and he thought he broke a tooth or lost a tooth from that fight. There's another lead. What do you do? No dental records. All you got's Vobel. So I go to Marina. And I ask Marina if she could loan me the x-rays from the autopsy. And she did. And she even gave me photographs of part of Oswald's skull with the teeth. They're dirty and gritty and green, but they're clear, very clear. He had natural teeth. The fellow in the photograph appears to have a missing tooth. I have not, to this day, seen an end to the discrepancies. I looked at a few of these documents, and one of the things I found was a medical report of Oswald in California at Max 9. What was interesting is the date on that medical record was at a time, I believe it was a day or even 2 days before the Marine Corps records show that Oswald in Japan boarded a ship in Yokosuka for the 3-week voyage to San Francisco. So it's a small thing, but it's another document that shows Harvey was at Max 9 while Lee Oswald was still in Yokosuka, Japan. And these things continue and continue and continue and continue. We've all heard about Roger Craig saying Oswald got into a Rambler. Nope. The Warren Commission says he got into a bus. When you follow those leads out, it takes you someplace. We've all heard that a person who was wearing a white shirt was taken out of the back of the Texas Theater shortly after, or at the time, Harvey Oswald was taken out the front of the Texas Theater by the Dallas police and put into a squad car. We've all heard about that. We've all heard about Oswald, a man identified as Oswald, driving a red Ford Falcon 20, 30 minutes after the assassination when Harvey was in jail. We've all heard about these things. See, all I have done is simply try to lay the documents side by side. He's here. No, he's here. If you've got Harvey in jail, you put him in one column. You've got somebody driving this red Ford Falcon, call him Lee if you will, put him in another column. And then go backwards and start separating these people to the best of your ability. The guy in the classroom photograph with a broken tooth, the thin guy standing in front of the Bronx Zoo, John Pick says was not his brother, put him in the Harvey column. The people that were introduced to Harvey Oswald, Harvey Oswald introduced himself to William Timmer in North Dakota in 1953. Timmer says he wanted to be called Harv. First indication I heard of the name Harvey. That's why I used Harvey for one of them. He, Lee Harvey Oswald, told William Timmer in 1953 he wanted to be called Harv. 6 months later, he's in Myra Drews' home class, and Myra Drews says, "How do you want to be called?" He says, "Harvey. Call me Harvey." So Myra Drews always calls him Harvey. So you go through these things. Beauregard school records, two people. Myra says he was in her homeroom class. Harvey, no question. But the report cards show that you also had an Oswald in homeroom class 303 on the third floor of Beauregard. So you put all these things side by side by side, and you have two different people using the name Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, in Beauregard, it might seem just absolutely astounding that you would have two people in the eighth grade use the name Lee Harvey Oswald in the same school. Well, we all have probably known someone, if our school is any size at all, and Beauregard was a decent-sized school, that had the same last name, Smith, Jones, Williams, whatever. And they had different first names. Nobody thinks twice about that, do they? If you had a John Williams in one class and in another class there's a Paul Williams, would you think that they're brothers related or anything? So if you've got Harvey Oswald in Myra Drews' class, he's a short, little, thin guy, and you've got Lee Oswald on the third floor homeroom class, he's a big, husky guy who gets in fights, why associate those people? What would be the reason to associate those people? Now, you see, what interested me one step further. Let's go one step further. I have an interview that Ed Vobel gave to the local television station in New Orleans, and this was very shortly after the assassination. And I listened to it very closely. Vobel's talking about Lee Oswald, Lee Oswald, Lee Oswald, Lee Oswald, Lee Oswald. Lee wouldn't take anything from anybody. Lee would not back down from a fight, and so on. Now, that's not Harvey, who Myra Drews says didn't have an ounce of fight in him. But Myra Drews said very clearly that it was Harvey Oswald in her classroom and his best friend was Ed Vobel. Ed Vobel comes running out of the basement Miss Deruce, Miss Deruce, a piano fell on Harvey's legs. So Dorothy Dubik and I, we go into the basement, and there, in the middle of the room, is Harvey with a piano on his legs. So we lifted up the piano, and that was that. So now, we've got Myra Deruce knowing Harvey, and Harvey and Vogel rode their bicycles together every day, according to Myra Deruce. Now we've got Vogel knowing Harvey Oswald. And a week after the assassination, we've got an interview with a local TV station, and Ed Vogel talking about his friendship with Lee Oswald, who he attended CAP meetings with in the summer of 1955, a year and a few months after he knew Harvey. He talked about Lee getting in a fight with Johnny Neumeier. I talked to John Neumeier. He was in Las Vegas. He remembered the fight clearly. Doesn't know if he broke Oswald's tooth, but said they fought for hours, a couple hours. And his brother got involved, too, Johnny Neumeier's younger brother. Anyway, what you've got is Ed Vogel, clearly, according to Myra Deruce, knowing Harvey. And then you've got Vogel, by his own admission, knowing Lee. You've got a very, very dangerous situation with Ed Vogel. Ed Vogel died in 1972, I believe. His father told the House Select Committee, when this House Select Committee tried to find Vogel, that he thought his son died under strained circumstances. He asked him to please investigate because he thought his son's death had something to do with the assassination of President Kennedy and his friendship with Oswald. So my take on that is, obviously, Vogel was silenced, and he happened to die. And this is something else. If you look at Vogel's death certificate, so I talked to his sister. His sister, her name is Sweetie Pie. Vogel had two sisters, and they still operate the Quality Florists shop in New Orleans, the same shop that they operated when Vogel was alive, his family operated. They still have the same flower shop. And she told me the story. He called one day from the Ochsner Clinic and said that he was not feeling good. He was in the hospital. They were going to admit him to the hospital, and they needed to do tests. But he was feeling fine. He'd be home the next day. Vogel died at the Ochsner Hospital, and that was it. He didn't die at this other memorial hospital, as the death certificate states. But you see, what we're dealing with is a document. And people 50 years from now would simply look at the document and say, oh, he died at this hospital. Whereas the real truth can be had from the sisters of Ed Vogel. He didn't die at this hospital. He died at the Ochsner Clinic. And people familiar with the Kennedy assassination know about Alton Ochsner. So my point is, and I know I'm belaboring the point, my point is almost every avenue that I investigate has a further lead, a further something that leads you like a tree branch to a big tree branch to two smaller ones and smaller ones. It just keeps going, and it almost never ends. Well, it's my hope that I can provide a foundation. My research, my documentation will provide in the future a foundation for someone to gather up my materials and further this work. I don't consider it my work. I just consider it documents. So if a person has a particular interest in a particular area related to Harvey or Lee, get these documents from the Baylor website. See if you can expand on it and do your own research. Now, there is an end to this research. I mean, I'm sure in the National Archives, if I spent the next 3 or 4 years at the National Archives 1 month out of the year like I did for many years, I'm sure, without a doubt, I could come up with more items of interest, whether it be FBI manipulation of witnesses, Warren Commission changing testimony, direct testimony of their witnesses, whether it's indications of two Oswalds, whatever. But let me just say this. All of the research into Harvey and Lee, everything I've accomplished, could end with one DNA test. And, of course, that's between any member of Robert Oswald's family and any member of Marina's family. If those DNA tests were to show that those people are not related, then you have Harvey and you have Lee, who are not brothers.
Just remember, boys and girls, all political people in power and in the ruling class, all are corrupt or criminal, some more criminal and corrupt than others, but don't ever rely on them, trust them for anything. That's just the nature of the way they are.